Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Los Angeles Community Policing and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I founded these organizations. I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, where I'll be your host for this night's show, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. Joining me in just a few minutes will be a panel of people who, like me, are engaged in the fight against child abuse. And tonight is an open mic show, which simply means that we hope the community will engage with us and will call in during the course of the show, offering us any comments they want, any questions they want, to join the conversation as they go on and so forth. Open mic shows are meant for exactly that. We really want people to call in. The shows are a different feel for us and a different style for everybody else if the community will call in. So please do so. We really appreciate it. You can also join us in our chat room. The chat room is now open. And that's you'll get instructions when you go in there. If you go in as a guest about how to create a screen name, which is our suggestion, because as a guest, you cannot type at all. You can only read what other people type, whereas under a screen name, you can type to your heart's content. And after all, isn't that the idea of a chat room, to talk back and forth, type back and forth? So please do that. And in subsequent visits, you will be recognized automatically. You only have to do this once. It's free. It takes a minute. And in subsequent visits, no matter what you do, at Blog Talk Radio, you will be recognized and automatically logged in under that screen name, which means, of course, that you will be able to type in chat rooms. You'll have all the permissions of a chat room. The other way to participate is by calling in on our dedicated number, 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118, and then follow directions to push the number one, if you want to join our conversation whenever you'd like to, and we'll bring you on the air. Joining me tonight are a couple of panelists. One is from rural Ohio. Her name is MJ Goings. MJ is a healthcare professional who's been in the medical profession as an RN for many years. She's a shift supervisor at the county hospital where she lives. MJ, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, glad to be here. Bear with me. I'm going on very little sleep today, so
sure.
I might be a little slow.
That's okay. You're little anyway, so adding slow to it isn't that much bigger deal.
Oh, I had to get up early. Had a birthday to see to and take care of. So
right, your granddaughter. So congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, let me bring Carol D. Levine, of course, who co-hosts these shows Monday to Friday with me pretty much now. Carol D. Levine is an author. That's why we use her middle initial, because her book is easier to find if you look it up using her middle initial. However, it's not difficult to find. You can get it on Amazon, for example. Carol D. Levine's book is entitled Panic Child, the harrowing true story of sexual abuse and neglect. And it's basically an autobiographical work that describes not only how she grew up and all the traumas of her youth, but also how it affected her as an adult. And then later, it's the story of her recovery, which began about 30 years ago. So Carol certainly has an awful lot to share with us on these shows and in her book, and we welcome her to the air. She's calling in from New Jersey. Hiya, Carol.
Hi, Bill. Hi, MJ. Glad to be here.
Hello, Carol.
Hi.
I see we have Val is listening. I don't know if she wants to join us or not. She didn't push the number one, so I'll wait in case she wants to. But we would love to have her engage with us whenever she's ready.
Mm-hmm.
Val from the 210 area code. There she is. Okay, here she comes.
Hi.
Did I embarrass you into calling in, Val, I hope?
No.
I
still have a cold, so I'm just going to mostly listen.
That's okay. We're glad to have you, and I know that I'm getting over mine, too, so I know how you feel.
Okay, a couple things to clean up. First of all, I was on the air, as you guys know. It was a botched plan last week for me to appear on a show in Poughkeepsie on an AM station that went through today, and then they invited me back again next Wednesday. So this is getting to be a regular thing, and I'm delighted. The pace at which they're asking me questions indicates just how interested and engaged the host of this particular show is in these issues. And although she's not a child abuse survivor herself, she's the mother of three. I don't know exactly what kind of following. 50,000 people, so it's not a small following, do listen. And over time, it looks like we're going to have maybe three or four or five shows with her that'll be a little library of different things. She's asking me topics that make me go slower than I usually do, which I'm delighted to do. And so because I'm going slower, there's more to tail off it. So anyway, thank you to her. We're getting some outreach there. And then secondly, I want people to know that I just placed on the front page of our website an upcoming event where I'll appear at. I appeared at it last year as well. This is the event that's put on by Barbara at the Petraluna Foundation in celebration of Male Abuse Awareness Week, which is December 1st, so it's the first week of December. And since December 1st is a Saturday, they're holding a pretty significant event, actually, Saturday night in Van Nuys, California, which is in the San Fernando Valley here in Los Angeles. They've got a terrific lineup of guests and pretty impressive attempt at getting some awareness for Male Abuse Awareness Week. And I'm going to play a role there. I'm going to actually be the stage manager of the show. I'll be on stage a lot, and then at one point during the show we'll speak to the crowd and so forth as well. So that's Saturday, December 1st. There's a link on the front page of our website in the area that talks about special features as of tonight, and I just put it there. So please do check it out. And if you can make it to Van Nuys, come up to the stage and say hi to me. It's under the recent NASCAR highlights section, along with the Bomb in the Brain and Jessica's Corner for the next week or so. Okay, that cleans up my... I also should say that between now and the event, Petra will join us. Barbara will join us, I believe, a week from this Friday, so about 10 days from now, about a week before the concert, she'll be with us for the evening as a special guest. All right, that cleans up the day, the night. So tonight is an open topic night, and I always ask the panelists and guests that call in early if there's anything in particular on their mind that they would like to launch tonight's show with, a topic that they'd like to start with, and so we'll do that now. Any of you ladies have something in particular that you'd like to discuss?
Well, It looks like I think MJ's half asleep and Val doesn't feel well. I was sleeping before and the phone rang and I spoke again to the lady from Casa Bill, and we're going to move that up a day. I'll send you an email because Thanksgiving is on, you know, on Thursday coming up. So that'll be good, and she's looking forward to coming on the show. So she'll be on Tuesday instead of Wednesday. I'll let you know.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so next week we'll have a couple of special guests, and that's how our shows go. We have 6 nights a week the evening show, and although we don't ever run out of something to say, it is nice that we intersperse our weeknight shows with special guests, and we got a couple for next week to break up the week for us. But Monday to Friday are topic-driven or special guest-driven. And, of course, we talk about their issue or their topic when we bring them on. And then Sunday night, we do the News of the Week show where we discuss the various articles that have appeared on the two websites, much of which is because of MJ's ongoing research. She does it every day, and I update both websites every day based on what she sends us. And then at the end of the week, on Sunday night, we have a panel of 4 or 5 people who come on, and we talk about the articles that have appeared off the two websites. That's Sunday night's show, and Sunday night's an extra half hour long because we always have plenty to talk about. Monday to Friday, they're 90-minute shows. All of the shows we do are recorded and available for on-demand listening anytime. Within about an hour of each show's completion, they appear and become part of our library. So that's how we do our show.
I'm sorry. I thought you'd finished. I was talking to someone late last night. I received a phone call, and this person has been pretty horribly abused. And may want to come on the show also as well. A lot of times when people have been abused, they really, really shy away from, you know, like talking or coming on a show because, you know, this would be the first time for this individual to really go on air and talk about, you know, his abuse, okay? And but I think he might be coming on very soon. I'm hoping that he will. I'm hoping he can get to that point. But he did tell me a story, and he did have some questions that he had asked me. And one was emotional, the emotional, what does it do to you emotionally when you've been, you know, sexually and physically abused, and how does it, what does it do to your psyche, you know? And I said, my God, these are the type of things that we talk about on our show all the time. When a child has been, you know, so abused, he may be listening in, I don't know, but when a child has been so abused, it affects you every way. That's why we have the bomb in the brain. I was telling him about that part on the front page there where we talk about the bomb in the brain. We are wired differently, and we go through all different kinds of things. In my case, I had the panic attacks. He had suffered a little bit from panic but did manage to get over it a lot sooner than I did. And then also, too, but he got into a lot of trouble. And I told him that it was something that, you know, a lot of times when kids come from terribly dysfunctional homes, they are so crushed emotionally. Their soul, their spirit, everything is just crushed when you don't get the help that you need. This is a terrible thing. Child abuse is a terrible thing. And the lady that I was speaking to from CASA today, we were talking about that quite a bit. I had another phone call conversation with her after I last spoke with you, Bill. And it does, you know, ruin a child if they don't get the help. And this young man hasn't gotten help yet. So I was telling him, you know, that he needs to get that help and trying also, too, to tell him where to go and get help, okay, in this area, in the Warren County area. So, emotional abuse is something that you're crushed. This is how I was. I know that I was terribly crushed as a child. I had no self-esteem, and this boy doesn't either. He still doesn't make eye contact, okay? And a lot of times we feel so badly about ourselves. A lot of times we suffer from guilt, and you know, we think maybe we could have done something to stop it. And that's not the case, because when you're a child and you're being abused, especially if it's a family member, if it's a family member, you many times don't know where to go to talk, to get help from. And also, too, many times you're scared, and as he was, all right? And so he grew up, and he got into, you know, a lot of scuffles here and there, and did a little juvie time, a little time in juvenile detention. And he didn't go to anything after that, but he's always on the brink of wanting to use, all right? He's into, you know, drugs off and on, and so he's dealing with that problem. So I was explaining to him that none of this is acceptable. We can't, you know, go into drug abuse like this. It's an awful thing when we do that because we're hurting our bodies, we're hurting ourselves, but it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon. It's not an uncommon thing for a child who has no direction, who has no support from home, and especially where the abuse is coming from home, you know, to turn to alcohol and drugs. So then I told him about our show and how most of the people, not all the people, but most of the people that come on, you know, are, you know, have a past where we too were into alcohol and drug abuse. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, alcohol is another drug. It alters your mind. And many times the way you behave, and so forth. And so I was dealing with him for quite some time last night. And, yeah, it affects you every single way. And what we talk about on this show is sexual, physical, emotional, and neglect. And unfortunately, a lot of times sexual abuse survivors go through a lot of those four or all of those four.
Right. So I get these calls too, and we try to describe. You know, one of the big things that I try to do is to try and find people, what are called in some circles are called peer groups or self-help groups,
mm-hmm.
Groups that have the same problems, you know, in common with each other, which means, you know, peer. That's where the word peer comes from, and they're on an even keel with each other when they walk in the room. Everybody's there for the same reason. This is a really helpful way, especially for people to get into recovery processes, especially if they feel like most of us do, that nobody's going to understand, that we're so alone, that we'll be judged. When you go into a group meeting, you're there for the same reason that everybody else is there, and there is no judgment about it. You know, you're not thrown away. You're invited. You find out that these people have the same issues. If there are people there longer than you, eventually you might be able to get the benefit of their experience, some suggestions of kinds of things to do. Of course, a lot of the groups have a method that they recommend of recovery, and if you follow that, you usually get better. But the point is that a lot of people that call me are looking for that, and the astonishing thing is that with the need as big as it is, and even this, you know, we talk about how aware we are. There's only two groups that I know of that have significant number of meetings under one umbrella. And those are the Lamplighters Organization, Lamplighters Movement, and the ASCA Movement out of the Morris Group in San Francisco. The first one has about 90 groups around the world. About a dozen of them are outside our country, but still it has 75 groups, say, in our country. And the second one has a similar number, 65 to 75 groups in our country. They're scattered all over. But compared to the size of the need, there should be thousands of groups that are sprung up. And now that doesn't mean there aren't individual groups in certain areas that don't have an affiliation necessarily with each other, because there certainly are. But it's just they're not interlinked, and there is no way to find them. Other than doing individual searches in your area, and that can be really confusing and disappointing, frankly, for a lot of people. We should have thousands of these groups,
mm-hmm.
because with 42 million American adults who have experienced sexual assault, there's a lot of us who have never even had an introduction to recovery, and that doesn't even include the rest of the groups that you're talking about, where, you know, violence is involved or emotional trauma or neglect. And we should have common meetings for all four types of child abuse or childhood trauma, where people are welcomed to just be there with each other. And that in itself really is a sound. You know, it begins to make us feel, you know, less different, separate, and unique from the rest of the world when we find out that there indeed are others like us who are willing to, you know, who are willing to share their own experience drinking, hope for the same reasons we're coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You can find, you know, nonprofits that have a single meeting here and there if you know how to do the search locally. But there's no group that's bigger than, as far as I know, the Lamplighters Group with its 90 meetings around the world. Go ahead.
What I was going to say was what I had explained, and this is from my opinion, you cannot go on your healing journey, you know, until you heal the drug abuse or the alcoholism. I mean, not that you can heal that, but you have to get help for that first. Otherwise, you're just simply not going to heal. I know that happened to me. I was working, and I was drinking, and I was working a detox. Shame on me. What a thing I was doing. I was playing the game. That's always what I used to call it when I ran groups and stuff and detox, playing the game. And I had to start looking at myself. Because I'd wait for the sun to go down, and my kids were all taken care of. Their homework was being done. They were bathed and all this other stuff. And clothes laid out for school the next day. And all the things that needed to be done at home was done. Now, this is when I had left my husband. It was my children and I. But he was a full-fledged alcoholic that never stopped drinking. I would go off and on, but certainly wanted that alcohol. And I had my last drink in 1981, thank God. However, I had to look at myself and realize that you go and you talk about alcoholism every day and work with all these people, along with the other coworkers, my other peers and so forth, that I work with and ran groups, did a good job, and look at you. So, you know, I still had issues. I had issues in my life. I was certainly a lot better than what I had been. But in order for a person to truly go on to the healing journey, which is what I was explaining to him, you have to get help. Maybe he needs to go to Narcotics Anonymous or something, you know, and get help with that and start addressing other issues, because people can't heal while they're actively drinking and drugging. They just simply can't.
I agree. I mean, to me, it was the same situation. I had become an alcoholic by way of trying to deal with the fact that I hated myself. You know, it was an attempt to change how I felt about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it turned out to be true. And in my case, I needed to go to AA. I thought I was going for relief from my alcoholism. Then I came to understand right away that the root of my problem really was in the secrets of what had happened to me and in the resentment that I had about them and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fortunate that I fell in with a group that that really, because they allowed me to keep coming back and keep talking openly about issues of child abuse, I was able to simultaneously deal with the two. So I got sober at the same time I got my introduction to recovery from issues of child abuse. They weren't separate. They were overlapping in the same thing. However, a lot of people don't have that as an issue. They're not alcoholic. They're not, they don't fit into a 12-step program neatly. Some do. And if they're lucky like me, or graced like me, I should say, that group that they fall in with will allow them to keep coming back and keep talking about these things. But a lot of groups won't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's a matter of finding the right situation. So sometimes, you know, it's not going to be applicable that we tell people they have to get over this or over that. Maybe just the root of the problem is the issues of child abuse, in other words. And so I'm looking for groups who only deal with that issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, because there are a lot of people out there who don't identify with being a child of an alcoholic or an overeater or a sex worker, all of which have anonymous programs that you can join, but none of which are there to talk about issues of child abuse. You know,
right.
And that's what we need, is we need places where issues of child abuse, no matter what else is in your background, you know, can be discussed. And if people showed up and they were continuously drinking and they were still trying to deal with their child abuse, I'm sure they would get the advice that it might be a good idea to consider some AA meetings too. You know,
right.
That would happen.
Right, absolutely. Well, I could tell with this person that he was struggling while he was talking to me, you know, and whether we're alcoholics or whether we're drug addicts, again, to me, I always look at it as the same thing because, again, it alters your mind, the way we think. We're trying to kill that pain, okay? That's what we're doing, okay? This is what he's doing. And actually, I've had a conversation with this person before, and I was surprised he had the phone call last night, and then I could meet with him if I wanted to tomorrow. We'll see, in the daytime. But anyway, the point is, when people are drinking, drugging, whatever it is they're doing, is they're trying to, you know, kill that pain of memory. He has so many memories. Now, this is someone who's very much in touch with their memories. You know, they didn't forget anything. Like I didn't forget anything. Okay, he didn't forget anything. And it's a very hard thing. Sometimes I actually admire, or I feel jealous, you might say, of the people that had the repressed memories, you know, where things, they don't remember things, and all of a sudden it starts coming back, and that's not a good time for them, don't get me wrong. But they've had years where, okay, they weren't functioning totally right, things were off, maybe a little bit slanted, and they didn't know why. This is the way it's been expressed to me. They were like slanted, and they didn't know why. And then, boom, something would trigger their mind and their memory. And they would realize that, whoa, I was abused when I was a kid, okay? And then the memories start coming in. I always tell those people, get help immediately, because you're going to need a psychologist or a therapist, at least a counselor who's in the field, all right, someone who knows about sexual abuse, because once the memories start coming back, you have to face them then. And you certainly need somebody you can talk to. Ooh, you know, that's a big slammer. But now, when you're growing, go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, you know, never having been in the situation that you guys have been in since I was never abused, I don't know which I would find more difficult. Would it be living every day with the ability to have the recall of what had happened, or living your life doing things that maybe you knew were wrong, that didn't make sense, you had no explanation as to why? I don't know which would be worse.
I've wondered about that, but I know. How you feeling, Jay? I feel the same way. The only thing that I can say to that, and what I say to people, is that when you're living with it every day, it's like it never went away. It's still there yesterday. You know what I'm saying? Like, today is yesterday. So until you really get on to the healing journey and get the help that you needed or that you need, you know, then you're living with these horrible problems every single day, and you have the memories there. You know, it's like, how do you deal with it on every single day? That's why so often people become suicidal, or they get into alcohol and drugs, things like that, because they have, you know, total recall. I certainly had total recall. Bill has total recall. And Val, I think you probably, I don't know, do you have total recall?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And so I've heard other people say, too, like just like I said, gee, maybe it's better to be the other way because you're not living with it every day. I don't know, except that things aren't quite right and you don't know why. But, wow, watch out when you start getting those memories coming back. I'm sure, which, of course, I can't identify with because it didn't happen to me. But I'm sure that would be a very frightening time, yes, MJ, for people like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As you said, that's why help is so important. You've got to be able to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and attempt to deal with what happened to you in your life.
Right. It is, it's very, very, you know, upsetting, trust me. I was speaking to a lady from CASA today, from Warren, Sussex County area, and she actually had made a comment about my book when it first came out. which I'm going to let her know during the week. I think she's so busy. She probably doesn't even remember what she said. But she said that, people are she said that my book was brilliant and well done and all this other stuff. And it's, it's a very terrorizing thing to go through. She knows too much about abuse, not that it happened to her directly, which maybe she'll share on the show. But it's something that when you've been abused, I mean, I told her my recovery started with the church. Now, I get into all kinds of conversations with people when it comes to the church, but this was good for me, and that's how I started. And that's where my recovery came from, because they saw something in me, these people, and my self-esteem started to build up from nothing. Okay, and this is what I see in this young boy. He's not a boy, he's a young man. Everybody looks young to me now. But anyway, I explained to him that we do have no self-esteem, until we heal. And that's why it's so important for people to get help.
Different people, experience different degrees of life problems at different times in their life, and they react to them in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to paint a picture that insists that that all of us are exactly the same. That wouldn't be true.
No.
What is true is that we tend to consider activities that we might not have normally considered as being viable and even as solution-oriented. For example, our drinking is exactly that. For me, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
It's an attempt for me to feel comfortable living inside myself, and I don't get to that place until I get sober, and furthermore, until I get an understanding of why the issues of my child experience have been running my life for the longest time. I don't get there until that point, but not everybody needs to make the same choices that I did in order to, be eligible for recovery. I mean, there are some people who grow pretty normal, except they can't hold on to a job, or they can't maintain a healthy relationship, or they're afraid of starting a family, or there's all kinds of ways that we self-sabotage out of the feelings that we have that we at first might not identify as being, effects of the child abuse that we experienced decades before. But mm-hmm. when we get in with a group of people, we hear that a lot of us are suffering from the same symptoms and have tried the same solutions that didn't work. And until we came to terms with the secret of our life, the child abuse, we didn't start to feel comfortable living inside ourselves. And that's what recovery is for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm, I don't want to paint one picture. There's no way to paint one picture, although there are many similarities and a lot of hues, a lot of colors in the picture will be the same. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have, in fact, there are people who grow up as perfectionists, which to me I don't understand. But they grow up as perfectionists out of their experience of child abuse. They wouldn't dream of making a mistake. They get straight A's in school. They never trip the life fantastic. They wouldn't even consider not going to their parents' house for Thanksgiving this week. It's out of the question, and yet they may be suffering all the time from a sense of low self-esteem that insists on they have to be absolutely perfect in order just to feel like eligible to show up for the family event.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the sickness too. It's the minority of us that experience it that way, but it's still a significant number of people, could be millions, whose reaction is of that type. And they may never consider that that child abuse has affected them as dramatically as it has.
Right, right.
I think there's probably more people out there that are like that than you think, Bill. Because there are people that, like myself, I can say, I grew up to be a perfectionist, but I was, the straight A student. I wanted to please, and you know, as I got older, I was like, this is not going to define me. This is not going to be what my life is all about. You know,
right.
I'm not going to let this break me. As a matter of fact, I'm not
right.
even going to think about it, you know,
right.
until I'm 50 years old. But I think we're the people who society's not seeing. It's easy to look at somebody who has a lot of problems and say, you know what, something's deep wrong with them. That, you know, something is not wrong with them in that sense, but, you know, something has happened to them, you know, that caused them to have the problems that they're having, the drinking. You know, we know everybody who does, you know, drugs and alcohol has some underlying problem, you know, to do that. But the people who don't have any of those outward signs, people would never guess.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, they just look at us and say, well, you know, he's
that's
a normal
right.
person, works every day, never had any, you know, problems with the law or doesn't have, you know, drinking and drug problems, you know, not
mm-hmm.
that, not that we don't have our problems, but they're not outward signs.
Right, they're not worn on the outside, but you still, they suffer from a lot of stress, you know, and fear of being found out and the anxiety that results from having to keep everything perfect, you know, keeping all the balls in the air, you know.
Right.
It's
keeping
really
the
hard to keep the secret, you know, that way too. It's just as hard. It's really tough. So there are, the point I guess I'm trying to make is there are a variety of different ways where you react to it, but a bottom line, the interior feelings that we have over them are frankly very similar. You know, how we feel about ourselves. And frankly, we hate ourselves. I mean, we hate what happened to us. We are really angry. We're enraged about what happened to us. We often feel guilty, as Carol said before, when that's the most inappropriate of all the emotional states, but don't tell that to someone who's suffering child abuse. They won't get it. You know, we feel it's our fault that we brought this on ourselves, or somehow we're responsible, or, you know, and all of that is wrong, you know, and because the adult in the situation was always the one that held 100% of the responsibility and the power, and the child is always the one that has no power and is completely innocent, and yet we don't grow up believing that.
Right, and even when we're to a point where we know and we understand that, it's hard to internalize that. You know, I can say it a million times. I can say it and believe it about you and, you know, about Carol and, you know, the next person. I can, you know, say it and with 100% conviction know that that's true. But
mm-hmm.
when it comes to myself, there's that always that self-doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that thing doesn't go away.
No, which is why when I'm asked, and I realize I wasn't asked tonight, but I'm going to offer it anyway. What's one of the first and most important aspects of the recovery process? It's forgiveness. But it's not forgiveness of the perpetrator. It's self-forgiveness that I talk
right.
about. I don't believe that you have to forgive necessarily. I mean, some people do. And that's okay. They're a perpetrator. But you do need to forgive yourself. And you do need to accept yourself as being, you know, human and flawed and having made some mistakes, just like everyone else who's human and flawed has done. And you have character defects and shortcomings, just like every other human. But you also have, you know, talents and abilities and positive traits to offer too, and our job is to stop beating ourselves up, you know, over everything that's wrong with us, and start paying attention to what we can, the contributions we can make, because we all have talents and we all have abilities, and our job in our own recovery, for me, I think ultimately is to try and serve each other, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
or to find people that need the kind of recovery that we've got and just don't even know it yet, and offer it to them.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that, Bill. You know,
yes.
what you said, of course, is very true. I've had to forgive myself for a lot of things that I did. I knew why I did it. I don't feel like I have to forgive the people that, you know, like I was telling the lady from Costa today, she wanted to know a little bit about me. So I don't feel like I have to forgive those people that, you know, that violated me, that raped me, for God's sake, or who molested me. I just simply don't, and I probably never will. They knew what they were doing, and I was a kid, okay? And they have no remorse, and so I'm not going to, you know, forgive them. But I had to forgive myself for my own actions, like when I was drunk. Some of the things that I did, oh, my God, you know. And I have recall of what I did. I wasn't so drunk that, like, I didn't know what I was. I wasn't, like, in a stupor, okay? I was acting stupid, but I wasn't in a stupor. So there's times in the past that I can look back to things that I did that I shouldn't have done. Unfortunately, some of my friends did die. I was into alcohol. They were into the heavy drugs, you know, into heroin. I used to watch them shoot up and everything, and that I was afraid of. I wasn't going to do that, thank God, right? But as long as I was having my beer or whatever I was drinking, I didn't care. You know, that's you do your thing and I'll do mine, you know? And never thinking, you know, that I was doing a bad thing, you know, with that anyway. I was trying to kill pain. I was trying to fit in. I was trying to feel better. I couldn't cope with all the things that I was so filled with rage and anger. Same thing, you know, with of my abusers and what was going on in my house at the time. So I had to do something to feel better. And when you're a kid, it never occurs to you to go and get help. I mean, this is what we're trying so hard to do today, is to get the schools more involved, get parents more involved where abuse isn't happening in the home. And if it is happening in the home, find, you know, tell the kids it's all right to tell. That's where the school comes in as far as I'm concerned. That's one way. So the kids have someone to go to and say, look, this is what's happening to me, whether it's sexual, physical, or what kind of abuse. And, you know, so this today is a different world than when you and I grew up, Bill. You know, there is help today. It's hard for some people to get help. It's harder for guys to get help. We've spoken about that many times, to find where to go. Unless you can go to a therapist, a counselor, you know, a psychologist if you need it. To have more groups would be a good thing. I'm having a hard time with this kid because he's not 19. He's in his early 20s. And where do you tell him to go and get help? And he's poor. Okay, so I'm thinking.
Well, that's why we need that kind of group. Because typically, the kind of group I'm referring to when I say peer groups are, first of all, they don't charge a fee to attend. They may pass around a hat or something and ask for a small donation, but they don't, you know, they're free, most of them. Some of them are run by counselors who charge a small fee, and, you know, if you're okay with that, then go to those. But the kind of group I'm talking about is, you know, peer-to-peer, which means that the reason for us, you know, for us having these groups is to help each other. So we don't charge each other for that.
No.
We pass the hat to pay for the coffee and the Xeroxing and stuff. That's about it. And maybe the room rental. You know, and the typical donation at these kinds of groups has been $1 a person or $2 a person for 30 years since I've been going. You know, it's the same dollar. So, so those are the, because there are lots of people, you know, you don't choose to get into recovery at a place where you're at a high point in your life. In fact, just the opposite is true.
Right.
You usually think one of the most depressing moments of your life, you know, the worst parts of your life, the bottom, you hit bottom, and then you decide maybe I'll try this as a last-ditch effort, you know, because you feel horrible and you don't want to feel any worse. And that's pretty much where a lot of us have to kind of be beaten down to that place in
mm-hmm.
order to go out and seek help. And, of course, getting to that place almost by definition means that our life is in a terrible spot financially often as well as every other way. So, you know, we're not ready to shell out $75 an hour to a therapist at that point.
No, definitely not.
You don't have to. No.
And we, you know, we were not able to, you know. It's and you know, a lot of times people fall down so low because they have so many problems when they do get a job. I call it sensitive, you call it, what were you calling it last night? I say sensitive and you say, but it means the same thing.
No, it doesn't mean the same thing. I say
you don't
touchy.
Think so? Go ahead.
No.
Oh, you said touchy? What'd you say? I forget.
Touchy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, to me, it's like pushing buttons. That's how I, when I say sensitive, I mean it that way. You know, he looks at things differently. I looked at things differently. I think that when people are abused, whether it be sexually, physically, emotionally, or from neglect, any of the four, okay, or all of them, for God's sake, I was very touchy. I was very sensitive. I call it sensitive. You could push my buttons very easily because I felt so low about myself. And I felt like I was being maybe made fun of, you know, if someone came out with a remark. That's how bad I felt about myself. I wasn't able to, like, tease back or something because I thought maybe they were, you know, they were pushing my buttons. They're trying to get me mad. And it worked. So, you know, when I was younger, trying to work, you know, as a late teenager, say, before I got married, the jobs that I had, I didn't last long at because I couldn't fit in. I didn't know how to fit in with my peers that I was working with. I felt so different. And I think a lot of times, you know, we do that. We feel different because we are different. We've been abused and we have all these issues. Not everyone has the same issues. This is true. And, you know, some have more than others. Some people go out and do more things that they shouldn't do, like I did. And but I'm certainly not unique. There's a lot of people that did the same things I did. But still in all, now that I'm 85% healed, I can look back. And this is what I'm doing a lot of lately. I'm looking back at that wounded kid, okay, that who, you know, did a lot of bad things, naughty things. Nothing that I went to jail for or to juvie or anything like that. My friends did that for me. You know, but still in all, you know, I have to forgive myself for some of the actions that took place because I was looking for attention. I was looking for love. I was looking for acceptance. I was looking for all the things I didn't have at home, okay? And this is oftentimes what happens to, you know, kids who have been abused. They're trying so hard to fit in, and then they get involved with alcohol or drugs, unfortunately, the heavy drugs. And, you know, instead of facing the issues, maybe not even knowing, not being in touch with yourself to even know why you're so angry sometimes, that happens to people, that can happen. You know, they get into trouble. You know, they just simply do. Thankfully, I never got caught. I'm going to leave it at that.
let me give out our phone number. We want people to join us and ask us questions or make comments or ask us to talk about a topic. Mm-hmm. And they can do that by simply calling 646-595-2118 and join our conversation by pushing an additional number 1, and you'll get instructions to do that when you call our dial-in number. Mm-hmm. We really want to engage with the community, and we need to understand what issues are on your mind so that we can, you know, self-direct our efforts towards that. And sometimes people will bring up things that we haven't talked about in a while, and it's just because they haven't been brought up in a while. There's tons of topics. There are no dumb questions. And the number to call in every night is 646-595-2118. Some people think of this group itself as a sort of a self-help or a peer group, which it is, basically. Mm-hmm. We meet here 6 nights a week in various configurations, but, you know, one of the things you can do is, you know, is you can use us in that sense until you find something that's local to you. We'd be happy to have people just who are listening and participating. 646-595-2118 or be in our chat room. But in either case, don't be hesitant to communicate with us. So push the number 1 if you dial in and get a screen name if you intend to use our chat room on an ongoing basis so you can type back and forth. You're on the air right now with MJ, the only one of us who's normal. We don't understand that. She wasn't abused in her job. With from Ohio, with Carol Levine from New Jersey, who certainly was abused many and very severely so. And she's the author of the book Panic Child, The Harrowing True Story of Sexual Abuse and Neglect. And Val from Maryland, who's more recently been joining us on a regular basis. We are absolutely delighted you do that, Val.
Mm-hmm.
And we really value your input. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, mm-hmm. We love it. Love having you here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Val, who's the newest of this particular group, can verify that we don't bite too hard. Right, Val?
Not at all.
So,
I'd like to comment when, they talk about hitting rock bottom before you get help. And I think, with a lot of things, that is true, that, you do have to hit your rock bottom. It's certainly true with alcohol and drug abuse. Mm-hmm. But I think with sexual abuse, sometimes it's quite the opposite. I mean, I found for me, I had to be in a stronger place before I could deal with it. I had to be strong enough, because what I did for 50 years is just stuff all those feelings down. If I even got a thought about it, it was like, la, 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 I'm not going to think about this,
mm-hmm.
and make it go away. So I just never really dealt with it, but it's always there.
Right.
And I think I had to get to a really strong place in my life, and that began with, writing my book, and just putting my story on paper. And when I first started that, I had no intention of publishing that book. It was just getting my story on paper, just putting my thoughts down. And that started me getting me into a place where I was strong enough to deal with it.
Right.
And that process has made me stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with sexual abuse, we don't have to wait until we hit rock bottom to find that help. We just have to be in, the right place. And sometimes that means, somebody reaching out to us, even though it's unbeknownst to them sometimes. Sometimes you're reaching out to somebody, and you find out, oh my gosh, I reached out to them in one way, but then I helped them in another way that we didn't even know that they had this, problem going on.
Mm-hmm. That's very true, and this is one of the reasons that it's very helpful to have people who are in recovery be willing to tell their story, or at least reveal that they are victims themselves of child abuse and on a recovery journey or a healing journey, because it might help somebody else who is afraid to admit it themselves to start thinking about, revealing it too. Talking about it too, giving up their secret too. And they call that the Eskimo in 12-step programs, meaning mm-hmm. that say, did God save you? And you say, no, God didn't save me. I was lost in the tundra up there in the snow and the ice and the glacier, but God didn't save me. An Eskimo saved me.
Right.
But the vehicle through which who of the person who carries the message is the Eskimo, they call it. And so we can be Eskimos for each other.
Yeah.
And we should be. I think I don't know how many of us there are who are really in recovery and comfortable enough to regularly talk about it. It's a small percentage of the 42 million sexual assault adults that we know we have, at least that many. But whatever it is, we're the ones that are now responsible for raising awareness, talking about the issue, being open about it, and so forth. And unfortunately, there just aren't enough of us to go around. We need to, if we're going to make this an issue that the country is going to pay attention to, then we have to have help of people like MJ, who's here with us tonight, who's, a normie, but understands the, the devastation that we're going through. To join us and be part of the fight to approach, the powers that be, a lot of them federal, to make this a priority, a national priority, what happens to our children. And it's not anywhere near that right now. So to ask for that kind of action is part of what we do every night here on the show, too. We don't want to just raise awareness. We also want to cause people to want to get involved. and actively involved. And we frankly believe there's stuff everybody can do, every adult can do in the in terms of protecting and making a better world for every child.
I think by sharing, our secrets, as we put it, with them helps so often. I have before me the newspaper, and the lady that's going to come on our show had made comments about, writing a book. And so, Val, you just mentioned this. I just want to read this a little bit. This is only a little bit of what she had said. But she says, I've seen firsthand the trauma that's carried on without intervention. I'm not going to mention her name. I want her to do this herself when she comes on. Destigmatizing sexual abuse is one way to fight the violence. This is what she said. Books like Levine are part of that battle. As painful as it might have been for her to use that experience to help others, I think is brilliant and brave. Now, that's just a little tiny bit of what she wrote. But you see, Val, all right, it helps. It helped me, too. I mean, I didn't really feel that much when I wrote my book because it just flew out of me. And it was something that I needed to get off of my chest because I'd already, been quite far along in my healing journey. But let's just say it put some closure, to my life. I can say that, absolutely closure to that part of my life. And I think, like what you said, it made you feel better by writing your book. And I think that when people do write books, about what happened to them, they share what happened to them. It does so often help that person and others. Now, this is how this executive director felt about it. A couple of things that she'd said there. So I think it is a safe place. It is a good place. And it is healing for the person. Another person who had written a comment thought that it can be triggering. Yes, it can be. But on the other hand, it can also be very good. And so in my case, it was a good thing to do. In your case, it sounds like it was a good thing for you to do. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who have written books that feel like I feel closure in my life after writing this book with the past. That's how it helped me.
I feel empowerment because now I have a tool that I can use to get out there as a vehicle to get to speak with people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I actually have a friend, an online friend in England, who just when I was ready to burn the last book, she requested a copy, and she is so passionate about the book that she's actually promoting it for me.
Great.
And
that's
not just
wonderful.
In England, but all over the world. I mean, she's going out and finding websites and telling them about the book. And, and I was to a point where I thought, okay, the book is written. I've shared it with a couple people, and there was a lot of pain involved in that. Excuse me. And at that point, I was like, I'm done with this book. This is just it. That's as far as it needs to go. And then she came along and she was like, there's no way. This book's got to get out there.
Well, I think that's wonderful. And when you have someone that's working directly with you, that is so good, rather than going through the self-publishing way like I did, that's very difficult. And I don't want to get onto
that
online.
Well, I did self-publish. Self-publish my book. But this is just, just an ordinary person like me that, took up the cause of this book. She read it and she felt empowered. She said, it was like reading her whole life. And she, feels like it can help other people and it can help educate. I have several goals for the book right now. One is for survivors to find, some help, hopefully some comfort and some hope.
Right.
Because that's the message of the book, even though, it starts out really, with all the horrible stuff about child sexual abuse, I did try to end it, that there's hope and you can survive and there is healing.
Right.
So, and you're not alone. And that's my first goal. And the second goal is to educate people who know little to nothing about sexual abuse and let them know that this does have a devastating effect even on the most upstanding of citizens, it's easy for people to step over the junkie,
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's not just that person on the street that suffered this. It's your next door neighbor, it's your sister, it's your cousin. You know, your best friend, you don't even know it.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. And you're so lucky to have someone that's like promoting, like she's acting sort of like a literary agent. You know, this is good. And I hope that she can really get it out there, because this is what we need. We need to educate people. Okay, they already know about child abuse, but we have to make them proactive, okay? Because of the Penn State thing and other things that have happened, not just Penn State, other things. This article was written a couple years ago, okay, 2010. I have the full article here. But, and, you know, I just read a couple things that she had written. And back then, it was considered more taboo than it is today. I mean, believe me, she and I had a long conversation today. People are talking more about, you know, sexual abuse today. And when I first wrote my book, Val, there were not many online at that time. There were not many books like ours. But now there's a flood of books, you know, like ours. If you go online, you see them all over the place. So this is, it can be used as a tool. Absolutely. Many times I refer back to my book as to, you know, situations that happen to try and let people who are listening later on know, well, this can happen because, you know. And I think it's, for me, writing my book was like closure to the past. I'm able to move forward, move on, in a more positive way, in a more healing way, and I'm much more sure of myself today than I was, you know, even 2 years ago, certainly 5 years ago, forget it. I still wasn't, you know, as far along as I am today. So writing a book is a good way, one way to heal and to help others. Absolutely.
So I'd like to ask MJ, as someone who has not been abused, how do you feel that we can best get people engaged without scaring them? Because it seems like, you know, as soon as you mention sexual abuse, and especially incest, that people run the other way.
That's not an easy question to answer. Mm-hmm. So many people were just closed-minded about a lot of things. And, you know, as Bill has said different times on the show, this is not a subject that is, you know, all about puppies and butterflies. This is a dirty, ugly thing to talk about.
Yep.
And people just don't want to hear it until it knocks on their front door. You know, I don't know. How do you change human nature? You know, how do you open people's eyes to the ugliness of what's going on around them?
What opened your eyes?
Pardon me?
What is it that opened your eyes?
I think a lot of it was just the fact that I have been involved for all my adult life in healthcare. And most of those years were spent in the emergency room. You know, basically, I want to help people. And I have seen some of the results of abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, you know, molestation. I've seen it all.
Right.
And when I first was dragged into helping Bill 12 years ago. With his first effort, I think I just kind of was dragged along into the second. But I actually think it was the fact that I've, you know, not been one of those people that could close their eyes to what's going on around me. I have to be very aware of it. So I think that's what it was for me. But not everybody's in that situation. And like I said, in general, people don't want to know about those things. My goodness. Mm-hmm. You know?
See, if I could interject, I think the missing element is, like Carol says, awareness has risen to the point where people in general know child abuse happens.
Right.
But where it hasn't risen, Val, to answer your question, is they're not comfortable talking about the issue unless because they don't believe that it's happening to their sister or their cousin or their neighbor, you know.
Right.
Now, if we can tell them quickly, the statistics indicate that it's almost impossible that you don't know people who have been abused. It's just that you don't know who they are because of the secrecy of the issue. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Did I lose you? Yeah. That might be part of it, but frankly, you know, the longer we talk about these things, the more likely we are to lose their attention. So there has to be, I mean, you have to be almost clever in a succinct way to say enough to leave them thinking and wanting to come back and learn more. You know, I know we overdo it a lot, and we lose their attention because of that.
Bill, you've talked, and we've mentioned on the show before, sad enough, we feel that in order to really get some motivation, it's going to take kids of, you know, some prominent person being abused and coming into the spotlight. And I thought of that tonight. I was watching some TV before I got on the show, and they were speaking of the rampant use of prescription drugs, specifically pain medications. And how often have I harped on that subject? You know, people don't realize it's worse now than illegal drug use. Well, Bill Clinton is now on the bandwagon speaking out against this because two kids of close friends of his both died a day apart from prescription drugs.
Right.
He feels they were it was an accidental thing. They may be, you know, who knows. But now he's speaking out against it. So, you know, this is what it's going to take, is somebody really prominent speaking out against child abuse. And I think that's really what it's going to take, you know, and get some of the movers and the shakers really getting out there and taking a stand and trying to make some changes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's right.
We can do it on a small level, you know, on a small scale, but to do it the way it needs to be done, you know, it's going to take somebody with bigger name than us.
Well, again, I'm the cheerleader. Here I am. And I think that we're doing a lot more than you realize, because we do have a pretty good following. People do listen. I was telling the lady today that I was speaking to, a lot of times people listen to the archives. As far as the situation goes, is to make people more willing to listen, I think it's who you approach, too. I'm finding that churches are more open. They're listening. Some of the churches that I have, Bill, I didn't go into a Catholic church. I have to admit that. I'm Catholic, too. But there are two churches that I've been involved with that just yesterday, earlier, I was talking to someone who's a Baptist, actually, and I gave her information, and I'm waiting to hear from her pastor that she'll see this Sunday or Saturday. I forget what she said. But they're willing to take all kinds of information about child abuse and talk about it. I try to go to people that I think will be open to hearing about it, whether they've been abused or not. And that's why I'm going to the churches now. And any place that I can think of, you know, that where people may listen. I take cards always with me. I know Bill does too. You know, our cards that we have for the Blue Ribbon campaign. Sometimes I take the written information as well. But the point is, not everyone's going to want to hear about it. Of course not. See, I just go out there and I do the best that I can with whomever I can, you know, reach. And I tell them this is an epidemic. That's what it is. We all have to become proactive. Keep your eyes open. Keep your ears open. I give them the telephone numbers to call, the 1-800-4-A-CHILD, if you don't want to, you know, if you want to remain anonymous especially. And they'll send people out, and they'll decide if there's a real problem enough, you know, if they have that gut feeling. Many people have a gut feeling that a child is abused, but they're not 100% sure. You call that number, 1-800-4-A-CHILD. You might have a few-minute wait because they're busy. I hate to say it, they're busy, but you get a live counselor. I did. I called the number to make sure. And or, of course, if something's happening right in front of you, for God's sake, you call 911. We know this. And it is our obligation as society, because we are in an epidemic. Our children are getting beaten. I've seen too much of that, which I've mentioned several times now on the show, about all the physical abuse I've seen. And, of course, there's sexual abuse, which we don't see, but it's happening. They're neglected. Maybe they're not clothed properly. Maybe they have too many bruises. There's things to look for. I tell people about our website. I tell them to go to our website. I give them our website, www.nasca.org. Go there. Look at the lavender-shaded buttons, as we call it. Let the menu drop down. Learn the signs. The signs are right there. I tell all kinds of things about our show and the people, you know, that we've had on as guests, and so forth and so on, and on it goes. And this way, you're educating people. They do look at it. Some do it right in front of me because they have their little computers with me, their little iPods, whatever the heck you call those things. And, you know, or others will look at it later on. And this is how you're spreading the word, but you're also saying, hey, it's time now that we start watching out for our children. Now, you know, when the first time I did, Val, when I approached someone, I felt very self-conscious. I really did. And the more you do it, you forget about yourself. This isn't about me. This is about getting the word out, yes, but being proactive. And people say to me, well, how can I be proactive? Well, just by making those phone calls that I just mentioned. That's one way of being proactive, by becoming more alert to your surroundings, starting, you know, to look at kids. And with that 1-800-4-CHILD number, that helps a lot.
See, I want to get back to, instead of cheerleading, the topic that Val brought up. Was how do we reach the masses is really the subject. If we are reaching individuals, I'll tell you, as far as I can tell, statistically speaking, we reach about only 25 or 30 people live on the air every week. We also reach between 1,500 and 1,800 who listen to on-demand versions. So that's not an insignificant number, but it's still a tiny number compared to the masses that really need to get involved if this is going to become a cause or a movement. Mm-hmm. You know, or we need to have tens of thousands at a time hearing these shows. Or something, doing something similar. So, Val, I'm at my wit's end sometimes to come up with things. I'm thinking now comedy might be the way to go. And certainly we have not used video ourselves as an organization yet. I was kind of waiting till we had a little bit of income to spend on it, but I may have to come out of my own pocket to do it. But just because it reaches more people, I know it does.
Right.
And the right comic video or the right message on a video will go viral, and that's the kind of thing that might be really effective.
Mm-hmm.
But as MJ said, I'm also afraid that it's going to take somebody's really high profile child to disappear some night for us to. As a society, want to rally to make a difference. And I bring up the Lindbergh case as an example, that kidnapping wasn't very high on the radar of what Americans cared about until Lindbergh's baby was kidnapped in the 30s. And Lindbergh was so famous and so big of an American hero, so much an icon of American life, that when Lindbergh's baby got kidnapped, it eventually became a national offense to kidnap anybody. It became, you know, and that's the kind of attention I'm afraid we're going to have. And it's a shame to say it, but, you know, if something happened to one of the president's kids, you know, or somebody very, very high in show business kids.
Can you imagine if, you know, Angelina's kids, or one or two or whatever, were kidnapped? Can you imagine? That's all you would hear on the news 24/7.
Yeah. But
I think, you know, we do hear a lot about the kidnapping cases. We hear, you know, they're publicized over and over, but people look at that and that's like the anomaly. That's like, you know, oh, that just, you know, that's the one in a million that are getting kidnapped. That they still look at it as something that's not in their backyard. I think, you know, what we need to get to people is that it is in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying.
But
Lindbergh was identified, he was the first of the kidnapping cases, and that's why we all accept kidnapping as a horrible crime that we all are aware of. But before
right.
that, people didn't take it seriously. It was a local issue, you know. And until we have some very prominent celebrity or politician or somebody of that type, somebody really well known whose child suffers child abuse and it's discovered, you know, and we all identify with that person, you know, and it would have to be somebody really, really high up, you know, for it to have that kind of cause and effect, you know. Child abuse is just going to be an issue that's somebody else's issue, like you say, until it happens to someone that we all identify with.
Right.
You know.
Well, one thing we do have, though, Bill, at least today, is we do have all different organizations that are working with children of abuse. Like this lady that's going to come on, okay, on Tuesday. She works with the court-appointed, she's a court-appointed, what is she anyway? She works with people, she trains people to go into court with kids.
I understand that.
From the foster
care. But Carol, you're going off the issue all the time. I understand that. And we need those people. We need people in every local jurisdiction to be working on this. But what we also need is we need a national consensus that this is a crisis, that our children all over the country need support and need services, and so do adults who have survived it, need services and so forth. And until it becomes that, then, yeah, we're all doing our little grassroots and local work, and it's all important. But even Tom Scales, who's one of the people who, you know, is a cheerleader for the Innocence Revolution, says the point of the Innocence Revolution, which is a one-day event planned for next April to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Child Abuse Awareness Month, which is April. They're going to hold an international event on April 14th, and in all over the country there will be different kinds of rallies and things and so forth. He said, but God help us if you know, we have these events and rallies and speeches and we give people, you know, balloons and whistles and a bowl of chili, and at the end of the day, they're standing there with an empty bowl of chili.
Right.
That's not what we need.
No,
you know,
and I agree with that.
And that's the same thing with our Blue Ribbon campaign. We don't need them to stand there with a blue ribbon. Mm-hmm. We need them to actively get involved.
Right.
And we need to find the message. I totally agree with you, Val. We need to find the message that coalesces all of us to, while we continue doing our local stuff, to come together as one movement, one cause, one voice. Because until we go to the government with that one voice, with it being, you know, the civil rights movement of our time is the way I think it ought to be, because children are denied their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness when they're molested. If people understood that and how true that statement is, we'd realize that we're denying, you know, a significant percentage of the youth that we're raising their civil rights. It's a civil rights issue for me, you know.
I was going to say, if you, you know, think back to 9/11, remembering how everybody felt at that time over the course of the first few days or the week or whatever, there was such a national unity unlike anything I had ever known in my life. Now, granted, it didn't carry through because we, you know, very quickly reverted back to our old ways. But if you can just imagine something happening of such a proportion that everybody in this country had that same unifying feeling that we had after 9/11, but it was about child abuse, molestation,
right.
and neglect.
Right.
Can you imagine? That's the kind of something we need to happen, tragically
right.
enough.
Right.
You know,
and those are single incidences that we get over eventually. They're crisis moments and
right,
stuff.
Right.
This is chronic, and that's what we have to
right.
let people know.
But as you say, we have, you know, small groups scattered everywhere. They have no real communication and unification with each other.
Right.
And they're doing their own little part in their own little part of the world, and that's great. And I don't want to sound like I'm being pessimistic, because I think we're doing a wonderful job, too. We work
right.
diligently, and
right.
you know, I would never say, oh, you know, we're not making any effect. We are. We're making changes, and they're positive. But it still needs to be a more concentrated effort of more people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Until it becomes understood as a chronic condition, that unless we make it a cause that all of us care about, we're not going to affect change. It'll be on the back burner, and not even one of the topics that they even bother to, you know, to test about its importance in the world. It's just not even on the scope, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, there was a time when women were terribly taken advantage of, and then there became a thing called the women's movement, and women's rights greatly improved. I'm not saying that they're finished, but that was an effort that went on almost 100 years ago. You know, there was a time when black and other people of color were really abused, and we came to recognize that as a society, and we had the civil rights movement. And I'm not saying that everything's perfect for blacks either, but it's definitely on the scope, and it's definitely something we work on as a society. There was a time when gay people were shunned and denied opportunities of different kinds simply because of their sexual orientation, and we had a big thing called the gay rights movement, and maybe we're still in the middle of that, but at least we're comfortable enough as a nation to have it it's on the table. It's discussed. And there are various topics that have been taboo that we as a society didn't ever want to talk about, like cancer. And I bring this up because it was a time when we did not discuss cancer as a society. It was the big C. It was talked about in secret. And behind closed doors, if somebody had cancer, you know, it was a shameful thing. Today, we celebrate all the opportunities that are coming along for research in cancer and treatments in cancer, and we, you know, with bright pink ribbons being worn by the National Football League during the month of November, you know, and so on. But we don't have, we're not even close to making the issues of childhood trauma get to that level of consciousness. And that's what we need to do. Something has to happen that brings us to that place and makes it a part of the lexicon of things that we as a nation do care about. You know, and until that happens, I'm afraid it's just going to be, like you said, Val, somebody else's problem, because we believe that we don't know anymore until it affects us. Doesn't affect us.
Well, we have a long ways to go, Bill. We do. We have a long ways to go. But I know that we're further ahead than we were 5-10 years ago. And I'm just saying that, hey, maybe, you know, maybe someday we will get someone like you're talking about that will make this a great big huge thing. I don't have the answer for that. All I know is if we sit and do nothing, then nothing will happen. That's all I do know.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
You know, take somebody like that, but that doesn't mean we should sit back and wait for them to just come along.
No. And as far as the Innocent Revolution is concerned, I tell people about it. I'm happy it's going to happen. But that's only one day. And we have child sexual abuse and other kinds of abuse. As I said, a lady spoke to me today and said, I know a lot about physical abuse, and I suppose it was in her family. I don't know. But I said, there was a friend of hers. I'm sorry. But anyway, the point is, I said, we cover all the abuses. It's sexual, physical, emotional, and neglect. These are all abuses, and, you know, none of it is acceptable. Absolutely not. You know, but the point is, you know, we have people who are talking about it now, people are trying, for God's sake, to run seminars to have it open to people in my area anyway. To the anyone can go. There's one being run right now while we're speaking in Warren County, in Newton, where the public is able to go in and for a seminar type thing, and be educated on sexual abuse and all the other abuses. And so this is what I'm talking about. This is why I feel confident that more is being done today. Is it the total answer? No. But it's a start, and that's what keeps me going.
All right, we have 90 seconds left on the show, so it's just time enough for everybody to go around and say goodnight. Would you like to start, Carol?
Yeah. Every night we're here, we're six nights a week anyway, and we talk about abuse of all kind, and, you know, we're here for you. So anytime you want to ask a question or whatever, give us a call, and there's never anything that's stupid, so give us a call. We're here for you, six nights a week. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. MJ, final thoughts?
No stupid questions, but you might get a stupid answer every now and then, depending on who's answering it.
Hey. All right. Yeah. Thanks for being here, MJ. Really appreciate it. Val, final thoughts for tonight?
I'd like to thank MJ, because we need more people who are not survivors to get on our side and help, because people are more likely to listen to you than to us, unfortunately.
I couldn't agree more, Val. She's such a valuable asset. She's here every night, and she works the midnight shift, the overnight shift at the hospital, but she's here several times a week on her days off, and every Sunday she joins us. And she is a really invaluable member of our group. This is Bill for MJ, for Val, and for Carol, and for Chris in the chat room, saying thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow night. May God bless you, God bless America, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Blog Talk Radio.